You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 231 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Sensational Wonder Woman number 10, Rorschach number 6, The Green Lantern season 2 number 12, Superman number 29, The Joker number 1, Batman Urban Legends number 1, Black Lightning season 4 episode 5, The Book of Ruin chapter 1, Superman and Lois season 1 episode 3, The Perks of Not Being a Wallflower, and Flash season 7 episode 2, The Speed of Thought. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. New Crush and Lobo series launches in June to help celebrate DC Pride. It's an 8-issue monthly miniseries by writer Mariko Tamaki with art by Aman K. Nahuplin.
Like we say a lot, we like DC trying different things and diversifying what they do, so I'm all for it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool too. And I noticed Marvel is putting out their own version of Marvel Pride. It's kind of cool to see that both companies are joining in on that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you.
All right, up next for DC News, Bendis and Maleev's Event Leviathan Checkmate is back after a year plus postponement. The 6-issue limited series is on schedule for June 2021. And the series seems to be renamed just Checkmate.
I am stunned that this is coming back. I'm not upset. Like, I was pretty intrigued by where it was going to go. I really thought it was just going to kind of be swept under the rug.
Me, personally, I forgot all about it. So, when I saw the news of it, I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot all about that.
I knew theoretically they were going to come back to it, but I thought that that was just like air quotes. Like, yeah, it's going to come back. good for them. I mean, yeah, I'm certainly intrigued to see it because I was intrigued by the series. So I definitely would like to see where the story actually goes.
Yeah. And we never got any real closure on Event Leviathan, so I'm sure
close.
So I'm sure this series is going to do that for us. All right, coming up next in DC News, The Court of Owls is coming to Batman: The Adventures Continue Season 2. The series will focus on Batman's investigation into a shocking death that may have ties to the mysterious Court of Owls. With the help of Deadman, the Dark Knight will uncover long-buried secrets that may prove that some legends are more real than we expected, and that they should have stayed buried all along. The first chapter of Batman: The Adventures Continue Season 2 will drop on a digital platform May 6th, with the physical issues hitting comic shops on June 1st.
I'm curious if this is going to be totally detached from season one, so to speak, or not, because I personally didn't feel like there was enough closure with that. So I'm curious if they're going to try and continue that story, if it's just going to be its own beast.
I was honestly surprised that that they announced the second season. Not that the first season wasn't good enough to get a second season. I didn't think they were going to do more. So I was surprised to see this news.
Yeah, I mean, that must tell you that it must have sold pretty well, right, for them to be willing to do a second one.
Yeah, well, Batman the Animated Series is pretty popular, so I guess that shouldn't be too surprising, huh?
Yeah.
All right, coming up next in DC News, actor Cameron Johnson, a.k.a. Luke Fox on CW's Batwoman series, is writing a Luke Fox story for Batman Urban Legends number 4. The story will be drawn by Marcus Toe and Eber Fiera and will go on sale June 8th. I think that's pretty cool news. Good for him to get a story published in a DC comic.
Yeah, I agree. That's really cool. I mean, that's awesome that he's given the opportunity to do that, and I'm looking forward to reading it, seeing what he can do.
I am too, and it'll be interesting because we'll get his take on the character in the story, so it'll be pretty cool. All right, and for our last bit of DC news for this week, Michelle Gomez joins Doom Patrol Season 3 as a series regular. She'll be playing Madame Rogue, a complicated and electrifying eccentric who arrives at Doom Manor with a very specific mission. If only she could remember it. I have a feeling this character is going to be really intriguing to see during this season, especially if she can't remember why she's there.
I have complete faith in whatever Doom Patrol is going to do, so I obviously am excited to see what happens.
Me too. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Attention, people of Earth! Looking for a way to kill half an hour every week?
Try the Flopcast. It's a silly podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, obscure pop culture from the 70s and 80s, and chickens.
Join us. Bring coffee.
We're on the ESO Network.
And we're at flopcast.net.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers. For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Sensational Wonder Woman number 10. The issue opens up with Alonzo going to pick up Katie with her meeting with the director. As soon as Alonzo walks in the door, Katie wraps him up in her lasso. Katie finishes her story to Alonzo of her first meeting with Wonder Woman. It was the beginning of a long friendship across many decades, and they got along because they were both single career women that were unmarried. Wonder Woman taught Katie not to fear and to push her limits, and Katie taught Wonder Woman to have fun. When Katie comes into the director's office, the director is not happy that Katie is sitting in her seat and makes her move. The director is very adamant about Katie going to live somewhere else. We see that a lawyer comes in and interrupts their meeting. Apparently, there's been a change of ownership of the St. Charles, and the new owner would like Katie to remain there for the rest of her days. The director has an outburst telling us how she really feels. We find out that Katie had put Wonder Woman's lasso of truth in her chair and she'd been sitting on it. Wonder Woman walks into the room and says hi to Katie. She's the new owner of the St. Charles. The issue ends with Alonzo as the new director of the St. Charles. And when he goes to check up on Katie, he finds her outside watching Wonder Woman playing soccer with the neighborhood kids.
So, did she have dementia or no? I feel like the answer ultimately was no, right?
I agree with you. No, I don't think she had dementia at all.
That doesn't really sit well with me, Drew. I'm not going to lie. That's definitely subjective, to be clear. But I don't know. I didn't really care for that.
I didn't care for that either, but I really liked this story. And I liked how it ended. Even though she didn't have dementia, she still had fun wearing her Wonder Woman tiara, lassoing her lasso. You know, she was just having fun, I think. But
I agree. To be clear, she was a very likable character. It's not necessarily that I wanted her to have something wrong, but I felt like the thing was basically like the entire, from what all I can gather from the comic, is the entire basis for their diagnosis was that she thought she knew Wonder Woman. And then that turned out to be true. Like, that's, I mean, come on.
Yeah, you're focusing too much on that comic's diagnosis of her and not the fun of the story.
I feel like it's the whole the evil directress, so to speak, is cartoonishly bad, right? And the only way you can give any sort of depth to that, to her reasoning, other than she's just a mustache twirler, is that she doesn't want to have to take the extra care and cost that caring for somebody like that is, right? If she's just a nice old lady, there's no real reason to get rid of her, right? Other than that you're just being evil for evil's sake. But if you're trying to, at least, again, I'm not saying I agree with it, but if you're going from a, well, she really does have dementia and that takes a lot more personalized care and focus and manpower, you could at least see from a very, you know, mean perspective where she would be coming from a business standpoint, right? But this one is basically she's just a nice old lady, and I don't like that.
Well, that lady got what she deserved.
But you know what I mean, Drew? I just want, like, I know it's just a simple feel-good story, but her just doing that just because is, I don't know. You could do more depth than that. I don't need, like, some in-depth character study, but we could do a little bit better than that.
Yeah, they could have. I feel like to do that, they might have needed to go a third issue.
I don't necessarily think that's true. I think if you dedicate, she can know Wonder Woman, but also be suffering from dementia. And I think that that's an interesting story that you can still do in two issues, right? And maybe that's part of the sort of, it becomes less of, this was a pure feel-good comic, and that's fine. That's totally fine. But you could have it be a little bit bittersweet where you find out she's right. She really did know Wonder Woman, but she is also losing her memory. She is also, you know, actually struggling with the things that come with getting older. This basically just made it seem like everything's totally fine. Literally nothing's changed. People just don't believe her.
I see where you're coming from, but
you know what I mean? Like, it felt like the story to me, Drew, it felt like the story kind of wanted to be about the downs, like sort of the bittersweetness of Wonder Woman makes friends, but they get older and she doesn't. But it felt like it didn't really want to fully go there. It's kind of what it felt like to me.
Yeah, I see what you're talking about, because they didn't commit to that. They kind of showed it, but didn't commit to it. So that's on the writers. But I enjoyed the story. So
yeah, well, no, yeah, it's certainly not. Like I said, it's a feel good story, so it's certainly not bad or, you know, abrasive or anything like that. I think it didn't need that much difference in terms of the storytelling for it to have got Ben. I think you could have improved it significantly without really altering the story all that much.
No, they just, what the story needed to do was show that she had dementia, and they didn't do that.
Or something. It's just, even, it doesn't, and again, it doesn't, I don't need to make it seem like I'm caught up specifically on that, but like, just in general, It felt like it really wanted to be a little bit of the bittersweetness of getting older when somebody else doesn't. And it kind of like it flirted with going there and then didn't. And it doesn't have to be dementia. It could be anything. Just her memory is a little bit fade, or maybe, you know, her physically she can't do something the same as anymore. There were no downsides to her age in this story. And it that's fine, but it seemed like the story kind of wanted there to be something with that, and it didn't quite commit to it.
Yeah, I'll agree on that. All right, let's move on to our next story for this week. Rorschach number 6. Our detective receives a package full of letters that were mailed back and forth between Laura and Will Meyerson. We get to learn more about both these characters as they correspond back and forth. We can see the friendship growing. They talk about their families growing up. We see them bond over the book Frankenstein. Laura talks about how she almost killed herself. Will explains how he feels so lonely. Laura talks about being 19, and Will responds with his own experience of being 19. And eventually, Will invites Laura to come see him in New York, and we see them meet with a hug. Now, the detective bribes the manager of the hotel for security footage. Once our detective sees the footage, he goes on a road trip to a house. We see he's knocking on the door, but as the audience, we see that there's a guy sitting in the house watching the debate and wearing a Rorschach mask.
I really liked the back and forth with the letters. I enjoyed that framing device for this issue.
I thought that was a good way for them to tell us both their stories of how they met. And I thought it did a really good job with the back and forth of the letters. Because you had the letters telling one story, and then we could see it in the artwork.
Yeah. And I liked the juxtaposition of that, where it wasn't what you were reading wasn't always lining up with what you were seeing. Like, they could be writing about how one of them is feeling in the moment, but you're getting a flashback to, you know, a parallel feeling of another time in their life where they also felt that. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I thought it was a really clever way to really expand the story of the characters by, you know, writing one thing, showing something else, or maybe the same thing, but in a sense, we were able to get both the story of how they finally meet up and find each other, but also more depth to their lives before that. I felt like we got a pretty decent insight into the artist's life prior to all of this, that we had gotten pieces of it before, but they managed to, the way King manages to kind of sprinkle that in, you know, just little bits and pieces. I found it pretty clever.
We also got the detective doing stuff, even though the story didn't move forward that much for the detective because the letters going back and forth. I thought it was all well blended together. Do you remember, is this supposed to be 12 issues?
I assume so. I don't know for sure. I would assume it is. I hope it is. I don't want it to be less.
Yeah, because if it is, we're halfway through the story. But it kind of feels like we're getting towards the end, but I don't know what else. I don't know how much more of the story they're going to tell us or whatnot.
Well, but we're still kind of feeling. I feel like we're getting to. He's going to finally figure something out. But then, where do you go for, like, once you kind of? There's something we don't know, right? The detective knows there's something that he's missing, and we, the audience, there's something that we're missing. And I feel like we might hit that missing piece soon, but then there's still the rest of I feel like there's going to be more of the story to resolve after that.
Okay. That's probably what it feels like, that thing we don't know about. And it could propel the story beyond them just dying. So.
Yeah. I mean, like obviously the main impetus for the story right now is a guy dressed in a Rorschach mask tried to assassinate a presidential candidate. And I think we might get, we kind of understand at least part of why they might have done that, but there's something missing. And then, but when we find that missing thing, I personally feel like that's going to open a door to the back half of the story, which is, oh, this happened? Well, what does that mean? And kind of go from there. I think we've spent a lot of the comic kind of in the past, so to speak, with these characters. I wouldn't be surprised if it swings then into the present of something else is going on.
Okay, I can see that happening. I'm kind of excited about that.
I could be wrong. I mean, this is pure speculation on my part, but that's just kind of where I see it going.
Either way, I'm looking forward to more of this story.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. The Green Lantern Season 2, Number 12. Hector Hammond wants revenge on Hal Jordan for stealing Carol Ferris away from him. Drotha, son of death, is talking with Hector Hammond about tearing Hal limb from limb when all of a sudden Hal lops off the head of one of his underlings. Looking for me? Suddenly, all of Hal's villains have assembled. The Black Hand, the Shark, Major Disaster, Tattooed Man. But they end up being fakes like the counterfeit Earth Hal visited with Flash and Olivia Reynolds. Samandra and Feck have been transformed into cannibal comic relief and lovelorn trans assassin. Of course, Hal has to kiss Samandra. The battle begins. Fek dies on his arse. Prince Vespero, the Wasp of Glendor, died as he lived, unafraid. Samandra died as a legend. Hal curses Hammond for killing his friends. But Hammond laughs and states they were just toys, and I can make more. Hammond tries to use Hal's ring against him, but it doesn't work. The ring returns itself to Hal, and Hammond is defeated by some bug thing. Hal Jordan turns off the intelligence engine. Rings are recharged throughout the multiverse, and they chant the Green Lantern Oath. Back on Oa, the new Guardians apologize for growing so old so quickly and making mistakes. And we see that Hal is promoted.
Except he rejects the promotion, right?
Did he? I don't remember that.
I'm fairly certain he did. I thought this was interesting, Drew, in that I felt like this was one of the, much like the season finale for the first run of this, I thought this was one of the more understandable comics. Like, I felt like I followed the story the whole time.
It was a lot easier to follow, I'll give you that.
Well, and I felt like it was that way last time, too. Like, that whole season was pretty, both seasons were pretty confusing most of the time, but it, weirdly, somehow he manages to tie it together at the end where you're like, oh, okay, I understand.
Well, I can tell you it was a lot easier doing my notes this time.
I thought this was pretty good too. I mean, it certainly benefits. The easier it is, like, obviously, I've, for the most part, enjoyed it either way, but I enjoyed this one particularly, I think, in part because I was able to pretty easily follow what was going on.
Yeah, the thing is, I don't know if his run will have any effect on the main story, or you know what I mean, main continuity.
We didn't think it would at all, but then there was something that we read that made it seem like that was actually the case, which was surprising. Drew, I never was expecting or necessarily wanted that. I just kind of wanted him to be able to just do whatever, just do his own thing. I'm not going to be upset if that's the case, honestly. I mean, I'm totally fine if it doesn't have any bearing on it. I think it's often, I mean, frankly, better that way.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering what the new Green Lantern status is going to be after we saw the Future State and then Infinite Frontier last week. Kind of worries me where they're going with the story. I don't want to... Just like you, I don't want to be seeing the Green Lanterns, not Green Lanterns.
Yeah. I agree completely.
So. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Superman number 29. The issue opens up with Superman and Superboy fighting aliens that are coming through a dimensional breach. We find out that Waller is working with Star Labs. They are opening the breaches and testing both Superman and Superboy against the radiation from that dimension. It's affecting Superman, but not Superboy. Superboy is worried about something, and Lois notices. The next time that Superman and Superboy fight the aliens, we see that Superman gets injured. Superboy confides in Superman that he can't go up against the aliens again. If he does, he will die, and he knows this because of information from the future. Yeah, I kind of found it sad that your backup story has better artwork than your main story. I gotta tell you, I did not like the artwork in this. I didn't think it fit the tone of the story.
No, I totally agree with you. It was one of those things that felt like, like, maybe if it was animated, that kind of art style might work, but I don't know. Yeah, I agree with you, Drew. I didn't care for it. And especially, like you said, that was that level of that quality of artwork, it belongs in a, as a backup story. And it was for Superman, like, you're in theory one of your flagship titles.
Yeah, it just didn't work with this story, that's for sure. And I wasn't too keen on the story either. I'm not sure what they're trying to do here. Are they trying to replace Superman with Superboy? Or is this supposed to be the death of Superman again? I don't know.
Well, it also doesn't make sense because it seems to imply, I mean, it makes sense in that Waller seems to want to see if she can kill Superman, but she doesn't normally, at least in my viewpoint, or my understanding of the character, doesn't want to actually kill him. She just wants to be able to if the need arises.
Right.
And I don't know. This story seemed to lean too heavily the other. I don't know. Like, it seemed conflicted. It didn't necessarily seem like she explicitly wanted to kill him, but she was also, I mean, making that pretty easy to accomplish.
Right. And I've always seen Waller. She doesn't want to kill Superman, but wants to control him. Mm-hmm. Which she never does successfully. So, but I didn't care that much for the story.
Yeah, I agree with you. Also, just because, like, come on. You're not going to kill Superman. And if they do, I mean, for how long? Right? I struggle sometimes when comics, and I don't know if I'm always fair to certain comics with this, but like when they kill a character, somebody on the level of Superman, it just doesn't really do anything for me, because if it's a main continuity title, it's not for long.
No, they'll come back. That's for sure. But it does feel like they're wanting Superboy to become Superman for some reason right now. And if that does happen, I can see it sticking around for a little while, but it's not going to stay that way. All right, we also had a backup story in this. Tales of Metropolis, Bibbo. Now, Bibbo is a character from the 90s. I'm surprised they brought him back. I haven't seen him for a long time. The story opens up with Bibbo and his girlfriend going to a movie. Unbeknownst to Bibbo, he's being watched by two aliens, Projectress and Deadstream. Now, Deadstream becomes a handsome man who keeps hitting on Bibbo's date. Bibbo finally gets fed up and tackles the guy in the lobby. Bibbo throws the man into a fountain, and the man in the fountain transforms into Deadstream, an alien lizard with water powers. Bibbo cuts the source of the water and then tackles the lizard. And then next we see Bibbo's girlfriend dissipate into smoke. Jimmy Olsen convinces Bibbo to write about what happened, and this is what the aliens were wanting. Their champions are gathering. Now, from what I remember of Bibbo, he was a character from the 90s who was this big fan of Superman, and he always called him Superman, Superman. And he owned a bar. So the stories they had of him back in the 90s, they were always kind of wacky and fun. And this kind of picked up on that tone.
It was more enjoyable like than the main story, like you said.
Did you even know who this character was? Have you seen him before?
No clue.
To
be honest, I was a little surprised when you said 90s, because I was assuming it was older than that.
Nope, I remember him from the early 90s. So, Rom, I remember he was featured quite a bit for the death of Superman, if I remember right. So, but I remember reading about this character. And it wasn't like a separate story. I remember him being in the main Superman titles, both Superman and Action Comics. And he just have a little snippet in the story doing something going on, or the story would happen to come to his bar or something like that. But he was one of the main characters in Superman for a while. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, The Joker Number One. The issue opens up with Jim Gordon. He's thinking about his last night in Chicago. We learned that he had gotten 5 officers demoted for taking bribes, and he had been promoted and transferred. An older officer came up to Gordon asking him if he got his boogeyman, which is the perp you see when you close your eyes at night. Now in the present, we see that Jim is haunted by a boogeyman, one named the Joker. Last week's Batman title did not mention it at all, but we see the aftermath of the death of Arkham Asylum, or A-Day as they're calling it in this comic. Gas bombs went off at midnight, with most of the deaths happening in the first 5 minutes. And it was an altered version of the Joker toxin. We saw the victim smile, but not laugh. Batman was the first to the scene, and he helped disperse the toxin from the air. Mayor Nakano directed his men to arrest Batman, but that was unsuccessful. The presumed dead included Jeremiah Arkham, Jonathan Crane, and hundreds of less colorful patients. The most shocking news was the death of Bane. We see that Jim Gordon gets picked up by a beautiful woman named Cressida. She wants to talk to Jim about the Joker. Cressida takes Jim to a mansion that is owned by a friend of her family, and she wants to hire him to kill the Joker. He gets an unlimited credit card while working on the job, and then $25 million to complete it. Now, I got to tell you, Cletus, I was iffy about picking up this title, but after reading it and seeing it focused on James Gordon and just not the Joker, intrigued me. And the whole premise of Jim being hired to kill the Joker interests me. The problem for Jim is it kind of goes against his morality, but it feels like he's going to pick up the job, even though we didn't see him pick up the job here. I'm betting in the next issue we'll see that happen, because it's where it feels like the story's going. And it's going to be interesting to see how Jim handles this. Is he going to do something like that? He's going to take the job, but is he actually going to kill the Joker, or is something else going to happen? It's going to be a battle with him and his morality, and it's going to put him at odds with Batman. It's a really interesting concept, I think.
I feel a little conflicted with this, because, like you, I am intrigued by a Jim Gordon-focused kind of detective story, I think. I'm hoping that's kind of what it's going to be. And not just, a straightforward Jim Gordon versus Joker, because that's not going to work. We've kind of talked about this on the podcast before, in other stuff that relates to Batman, but I do worry that they're drawing a lot of attention to a problem that you can't really resolve with superhero comics. Because when you really look at it closely, it really does make no sense that Joker's allowed to still be alive, right? Like, and there's really no, I don't think, really good way you can justify it. I know writers often try to figure some justification for why Batman doesn't do it, and obviously he doesn't kill, right? But beyond that, I do feel like writers often struggle to come up with a good reasoning for why he's allowed to stay alive. And when you do a story, especially a story like what this one's going to be, and you really are putting the spotlight heavily on how much of a threat to society this guy is and how dangerous he is to be left alive, you're drawing focus to a problem that you can't solve, because he has to stay alive. He's the Joker. These are comics. They're being written to sell. You have to keep the Joker alive. That's the real reason. I think that's the big problem, is that the real answer to why is the Joker never killed is because the Joker's too popular. You can't kill him.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's the real reason. A lot of times in the older stories, we see Joker would die somehow, and then all of a sudden he's back for some reason. And I've always liked that mystery of that. You think the Joker is gone, but he's not really, and he comes back. In the newer comics, he's always getting thrown into Arkham and getting out. And it might be interesting to see them go back to the old... looks like the Joker fell in the river and drowned, but nope, he's back, kind of thing. So that could be an interesting take. A Joker that, quote unquote, resurrects, or, has a tendency to not actually die. So, and maybe I just like that because I'm old school.
I would like them to get away from whether or not the Joker should die, because I think ultimately the answer is probably yes, right?
It's
hard to argue. And so I personally find it futile to be like, well, let's really think about this, because it's like, well, I mean, yeah, yeah, it, society would be a better place if he wasn't allowed to keep surviving. But he is. He's too popular of a character. And like I said, I just worry. That's why I said I feel conflicted on this comic, because I did like this issue and I'm intrigued on where you can go with the story. But I do ultimately worry that it's wrestling with an idea and a theme that it can't really answer, because the real answer has nothing to do with the story itself.
Yeah, I can see where that's going to be a problem. But I'm interested in seeing where this story is going to go. All right. We also had a backup story in this, a punchline backup. Alexa K, a.k.a. Punchline, has pleaded not guilty for the crimes or lives lost during her time as the Joker's protege. Most of the public seems to be in favor for the release of Punchline. The prosecution is at a loss on how to win the trial, and they find out that witness number two has been pulled out of a river, and the rest of the evidence is all circumstantial evidence. So the district attorney needs something the public can't deny. At Blackgate Penitentiary,
the fact that two witnesses have died wouldn't that wouldn't seem a little odd? That wouldn't be worthwhile to talk about?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but it's still two witnesses that are gone with circumstantial evidence. All you have to do is convince a jury that there's not enough evidence to prove it, so.
Well, yes, yeah, you're certainly right there. I do feel like they kind of overlooked that, like, oh, well, this witness died. Guess we can't do anything with that. Well, you could. It's possible you don't find anything and it stays circumstantial. I agree. But also, you could find something that does directly tie her or his or her death to Punchline.
Yep. It's all about convincing the jury. Now, at Blackgate Penitentiary, Punchline receives the Ace of Spades, the calling card of the Queen of Spades. Punchline gets angry and goes down to the Queen of Spades cell and beats her up. Blackbird suits up and heads to Snyder College to find some evidence that will help the prosecution. Question for you. Punchline beating somebody up in prison, that's not, that wouldn't be used to help further the DA's case?
This is the thing, Drew. I've been struggling a lot with this Punchline story back with the one shot that we got and then continuing into this, because it's just a lot of I feel like the writer Tinian is asking me to really, really go out on a limb and suspend a significant amount of belief in order to buy into the story. Like, I know I'm reading a comic in which a guy dresses up as a bat. So like, I'm willing to give you a certain benefit of the doubt, but I personally, for me, Drew, I feel like Tinian is asking me to really ignore a lot of stuff. Like you said, she, I think, murders a gal in prison. That's kind of what it seemed like. Best case, she knocks the ever-living crap out of her. That's best case. I think she killed her. Witnesses are being murdered. And like you said, yes, maybe you don't find anything that can tie that to the case and the jury is unconvinced, but you could. And they're not even looking. It's like the witness is killed. Guess we cannot do anything with that ever again. That matter is resolved. The person's dead. That's final, because that's how the law works. If you kill enough people, Drew, nobody can testify.
I'm laughing here because even though I was arguing against you there, that's not how I feel. I don't understand how Tinian is trying to make Punchline look so good when she's been aligned with the Joker. I cannot see. He keeps having the people of Gotham cheering for Punchline to be free, but I don't understand why. If you're aligned with the Joker, I can't see how people would be cheering for her. It doesn't make sense to me. And Tinian has done nothing to convince me of that. Even though I was arguing the other side there, I don't believe that at all. So, and it doesn't make sense to me why the public would be pushing for Punchline to be freed. It just doesn't make sense to me.
I also, the other thing, I've just, again, to be clear, this is subjective stuff for me, but I've struggled to get into the Punchline, some of the Punchline things, because I feel like Tinian is going out of his way to make Punchline succeed at so much. Like, let's talk the prison scene, for example. She just waltzes into what is effectively the kingpin of the prison,
waltzes into the cell and by all appearances, beats her to death with ease. What? Drew, what? What is that? I've never been to prison. I can't speak to how that works. I'm pretty confident that that's not how that works.
I agree with you. I can't see the inmates' doors hanging open and them just walking around willy-nilly.
I can buy that, but the fact that, again, this is effectively a game. Like, the only difference between her doing this and walking into a mobster's restaurant is that we're set in a prison. That's really the only difference. I buy that she can walk into the cell, but that her guards, so to speak, don't they just all stand there and let it happen? What? I mean, it's just, like I said, it's just basically whatever Punchline wants to do just works, whether it makes any logical sense or not. Tinian's basically just like, look at what a mastermind genius and physical fighter she is. She can do all of these things. Like, but this didn't make sense. She murdered her college dean and nobody caught on to that. And nobody's caught on to the murdered witnesses and nobody's figured this out. Nobody saw her standing front and center during the entire Joker War thing. And like I said, he is asking me to just go out on such a limb. I can have suspension of belief for a bit, or disbelief, but it's just so much. I can't ignore everything.
Well, that's because Tinian wants Punchline to be the next Harley Quinn, and he's trying really, really, really hard to make that happen, and it's just not working.
I feel like he's accomplishing the opposite. Like, the harder that he tries to make her so good at all of this stuff and all of these things falling in her favor, and the more it feels like he's bending over backwards to do this stuff, the more it makes me dislike the character. Like, I actively dislike this character now. Like, before, I didn't really care. I just thought it was a stupid idea and it would go away. But I actively, and that's stupid. It's a fictional character. But I actively dislike it because I just feel like a writer's just bending all of these logic and story things just to make his character. It's like the villain version of a Mary Sue.
I don't see Punchline sticking around after Tinian's done.
I do feel like at this point she probably will, because he's got the benefit of writing on the most popular book. And all you got to do is just be persistent, and it will ultimately stick because enough people will see it. Joker's daughter is still a thing, Drew. So let's not overestimate the ability of the Batman title to make stupid characters stick.
That is very true. And Punchline is not gonna be a Harley Quinn. I can tell you that.
He's gonna try. He's gonna try so damn hard.
Yeah, he is, but I don't see that succeeding. Not the way he wants it to, anyways. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman Urban Legends number 1. We had several stories in this. First one is Red Hood and Batman in Cheer Part 1 of 6. Red Hood is tracking down the maker of a new drug called Cheer Drops. It gives people a sense of euphoria and extremely pleasant hallucinations. Its addicts can end up in a trapped state, though, walking in front of cars, drowning, committing harm to themselves. We get a flashback scene to when Jason Todd is training to be Robin. Alfred gets on him for not doing his training, and Jason finds Batman's gun collection and questions him about it. Batman replies he hates guns, but he still needs to know them for his forensics work. Guns are a coward's weapon, and we will not be cowards. Now, Batman saves a guy on Cheer Drops who is clearly hallucinating, and we see him jump off a building. One of the cops tries to arrest Batman, while the other states Batman is not the bad guy, and we're starting to see the change of the police's opinion of Batman. The Red Hood comes across a kid named Tyler, whose mother is in a drug-induced coma. Jason has his problems dealing with this because his own mother overdosed. He calls an ambulance, and then he calls Oracle to trace the number of the dad. Back in the Batcave, Batman runs a chemical analysis on the drug. The makeup of the drug is similar to the one used by Scarecrow. Batman calls Oracle to check on the whereabouts of the Scarecrow's associates, but Oracle has nothing. And she tells him that Jason is also working the case, but Batman wants to work alone. Red Hood tracks Tyler's dad to the Cheerdrop factory, and when Red Hood confronts him, he says he doesn't give a bleep about the kid or his mother. And Jason loses it and shoots him dead. Even though I'm not a big Red Hood fan, I really like this story. The artwork was good. I like the gritty, realistic style of the story in the present, and I like the more animated style in the flashbacks. I think having the two different art styles for the storytelling was a great choice.
Drew, I agree with you. I thought this was a really good story. I was not surprised that it was well written because I'm a fan of Chip Zdarsky. I was a little bit surprised at the seriousness of the story. Not that he can't do that. He so frequently tends to do comedy stuff that I was expecting something a little lighter. But I was pleasantly surprised. Like I said, I was not expecting this style of story from him, but it was really good. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it continued.
I really enjoyed it too. And I think the artwork really pushed the story too, because the grittier artwork that was in the main part of the story, it fit with it. And I think the flashbacks being in the more animated style, it felt the tone of the flashback very well. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to reading more of this. The next story we had in this was Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy in New Roots. Harley Quinn has recently moved back to Gotham, and we see she's reminiscing about her relationship with Poison Ivy. We see this is to be continued in the pages of Harley Quinn and Batman. This was a fine story, but honestly, I wasn't that invested in it.
I wasn't, but I did think it was a decent setup, and I liked the kind of back and forth. Nothing, like you said, nothing special, but also, I mean, it was good enough that I would continue reading the story is trying to tell.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, the next story we had in this issue was The Outsiders in The Caretaker, Part 1 of 3. We see that Katana reneged on a deal she made with a mysterious person. They chase after Katana and Black Lightning. Metamorpho is under a magic spell and captures Katana and Black Lightning. Black Lightning wakes up in a cell, and he uses electricity powers and discovers that Metamorpho is the cell and the whole tower that he's in fact. It was kind of interesting, but honestly, I wasn't that invested in the story. They didn't give us enough to... I don't think they gave us enough to get invested in the story, really.
I agree with you totally. Like you said... The thing with Metamorpho being the prison cell itself, that's pretty cool. That's really interesting. But I didn't care. I feel like enough understanding of what the story was even about. And there just certainly wasn't enough there for me to care about what little story bits we did get.
Agreed. All right. And the last story we got in this issue was Grifter in the Long Con, Part 1 of 5. The Grifter is working for Lucius Fox. We see him mess up and take out guards for a man that Lucius was meeting. Luckily, Mr. Fox wasn't planning on taking the deal. Grifter goes to see the Penguin, and Penguin introduces Grifter to Nora Fries, and I'm not really sure why. Later on, Batman shows up and tussles with the Grifter. Batman wants to know why the Grifter was at the Penguin's bar. Grifter tells him he was meeting with his friend Jack Daniels. Batman is not amused and eventually leaves. Grifter gets into a restricted area with some sort of computer. He thinks Fox knows what he is up to. And then at the end of the issue, we see Batman and Nightwing shows up at the Gotham Ritter, and Nora Fries is dead. To be continued. I had issues with this story, but with Batman and Nightwing being in it, it had me half interested in what was going on, but I'm not a real big fan of Grifter, and I didn't really care for a Grifter story, but I am curious to see what is going on and what's got Batman and Nightwing's attention.
Drew, I feel like I should have known this. I didn't remember that Nora Fries was alive and out and about, or I guess she's not now, but
Didn't remember that being a thing.
I had forgotten about it till I saw her in this, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. I don't remember the exact story, but I do remember her being resurrected by Mr. Freeze at some... Oh, now that I think about it, wasn't it a Tamazi story?
Oh, yeah. Well, that would explain why I don't really remember it.
So, it was in Tamazi's Detective Run, now that I remember. He brought Nora back, and I can't remember. She, like, took over being Mr. Freeze or something. I don't remember. But anyways, I don't know why she's dead in this, or what the point was bringing her back to kill her off, but I am kind of interested in why Batman and Nightwing are interested in what's going on. So, and I'm sure we'll see this backup story again in the future. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our CW shows.
Hey everyone, this is George Tripsis, co-host from the Metal Geeks podcast, along with Carrie the Metal Geek and Brutal Dave. Our show is where we bring the metal geek culture and heavy metal culture and mash it into the geek culture. Come listen to our show where we talk about movies, comic books, Disney stuff, and mostly about movies where I'm always right and Carrie's never right. Check us out at metalgeeks.net and catch us on all your ear hole listening podcast devices.
I'm Carrie the Metal Geek and I approve this message.
And we're back. Let's talk Black Lightning, Season 4, Episode 5, The Book of Ruin, Chapter 1, Picking Up the Pieces. The episode opens up with the Pierce family, Gamby and TC in the sanctum. Jefferson swears that Jennifer is not dead. He can feel her. TC gets a message from a satellite, and they find out Jennifer's energy particles. Oh, and they find Jennifer's energy particles. To reconstitute her, they need a Hydron Particle Condenser that Star Labs has in Central City. And the Flash brings it to Jefferson, but it's off screen. And I gotta tell you, I was disappointed.
Yeah, but I mean, I just don't think that kind of cameo is possible with the current way they have to film these shows.
Oh, definitely. And the fact that I think Black Lightning films in Atlanta... And Flash is in Vancouver, so that would be a much more difficult crossover.
Honestly, the fact that they even acknowledge that they're in the same world is, I think, a huge... I mean, obviously that wasn't the case until now anyway, but that's a huge change for the show. I thought that was... Like I said, obviously it's not as satisfying as Barry actually showing up, but even doing that at all, I thought was pretty cool for the show.
I did too. Now we see that Jefferson puts on the suit and goes to the ionosphere. He absorbs Jennifer's energy, but it knocks him out, and he falls to Earth. Gamby is able to send a signal to his earpiece to wake him up, and then Jefferson lands safely. Police Chief Lopez publicly announces that the 100 are responsible for the assassination of Mayor Billy Black, and an arrest warrant has been issued for Lala. The police chief goes on to report that the death of 24-year-old Libdell Jackson... Lightning has become named the number one suspect. A metahuman task force has been created to hunt down the vigilantes. And Lyndall Jackson was the guy that we saw Jefferson break his leg. But we saw that Lala actually killed him. Black Lightning goes to take down Lala for the death of Mayor Billy Black. Black Lightning learns from Lala that it was actually Tobias behind the killing. Destiny reaches out to Lala and calls for a truce between the 100 and the Cobra Cartel. When Lala goes to meet Destiny, it turns out to be a setup with Lala shot multiple times. He resurrects while Destiny, watching from a nearby, calls for someone to bring in an assassin that specializes in metahumans. At the end of the episode, the process to convert Jennifer back into her body is complete, and when Jennifer steps out of the machine, this newly formed person looks absolutely nothing like Jen. I don't know about you, but I was shocked by that. I did not realize that they were going to replace Jennifer with a different actress.
Yeah, I didn't either. One thing I think is working in the show's favor with this episode in particular is the fact that it's the final season. And we also knew that the actress who had played Jen wanted to be done with the character anyway. And so there was a lot of like outside of the show stuff that you could be convinced that what they were trying to tell you was actually happening. Like she really could have died. And I thought actually made, I was much more invested in this than I normally would be, because normally you'd be like, oh, whatever, the character's coming back. They're not writing that character off the show, especially not this early in the season, but it's the final season, first off. And then secondly, we know that actress wanted to be done. And so it's like, well, she might actually be dead. Or like when a new actress shows up at the end of the episode, if this wasn't the final season and if we didn't know that this actress wanted to be done, I would still not be entirely convinced that it wasn't going to change back.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking, because a lot of times we hear about this stuff through the news, and the show did a good job of not revealing that.
I agree. Like I said, I very much enjoyed this. I was very invested in this story, much more than I would normally be, because it was a legitimate mystery whether it was going to work and how it was going to work and all that. That sort of suspense. I know shows try to do that, but it never fully works, because you know that it has to work. And so this was refreshing, because I felt like for once we didn't know that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was finally great to see Jefferson put the suit back on too.
Yeah. One complaint I do have to have, I know I talked about this a little bit last episode, but the police chief is really falling extremely flat with me. She's just so one-dimensional to me right now. She's just antagonistic as of now for the sake of being antagonistic. It's unusual for this show. I feel like this show is usually so much better about giving their villains nuance and there being a reason for why they're doing the bad things that they do. You know what I mean? Like, think about Lala. Like, Lala does a lot of pretty abhorrent things, but you also kind of understand why he does the things he does. And there's always a sort of reason to them. He also does have his own kind of sense of justice that obviously doesn't line up with the law exactly, but there is a sense of justice there. Or even like Tobias Whale, there's always, you can kind of understand why he's doing the things he's doing. You know what I mean? Like, there's a plan there. Like, he's not just, or if he does something that's irrational, you understand why he's irrational in that moment emotionally. What the police chief is doing with villainizing the vigilantes, and especially with pinning the murder on Lightning, the show is blatantly telling you it makes no sense. There's no basis for this. And this is unusual for this show and for these writers. It's not giving you a reason for why she's being so irrational. It's just like, it just feels like she's antagonistic for the sake of being antagonistic. There's no rationale behind it.
Yeah. They're not showing us why she's being biased against metahumans.
But like, irrationally biased. The pinning the murder on Lightning and calling her suspect. I'm trying to think of what the term is. What was it? Number one.
It was suspect number one.
Suspect number one, or like the most wanted person in Freeland. It was like, what? Like, that's such a, you know what I mean? Like, that's escalating the problem so significantly, but there's no logic behind it. And that's so unusual for this show, because usually there, you can understand why the person is doing the antagonistic thing that they're doing. And this one's just like stupid. I don't know how else to put it. She's just doing it just to do it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. One of the things, I think they've done a good job with Lala this season. We know Lala's a bad guy, but he respects Black Lightning. Even though him and Black Lightning have butted heads before, he does have a respect for him. And I think it was last episode or the episode before, he even said he was glad to see that he was back. It might have been this episode he said that. I can't remember. But anyways, he does have a respect for Black Lightning and sees why he's good for the community, even though they might be at odds.
He has his own sense of, he does have like this, you know, twisted sense of justice and good. Like, he's not just a, you know, he's not a one-dimensional villain. And that's what makes the police chief so odd to me, is that there's no depth or dimension there. She's just mean for the sake of it. Like, there's just no reasoning to it.
They may give that to her at some point, but they just haven't got there yet.
Well, but then again, all of that, that's all, even that is unusual for the show.
True. That's true. But I'm really enjoying Black Lightning, and was glad to see that we had that twist this past week.
I said, I was pretty into this episode. My girlfriend, who watches this show pretty in like on and off, she was very into the episode, which again tells you how well they presented the whole problem and managed to hook you in as a viewer.
Yeah, they did a great job of that. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Superman and Lois, Season 1, Episode 3, The Perks of Not Being a Wallflower. The episode opens up with the Kent family trying to decide on colors of paint for the house. Clark hears trouble and flies off to help with a collapsing bridge somewhere off in the eastern half of the world. Clark and Lois talk to the boys about the importance of keeping a low profile at breakfast, and Clark explains how he uses his super hearing to the boys. Jordan gets slammed against the locker by Sarah's boyfriend. John runs up to help him, and we see Jordan is making a fist like he's going to punch him when Clark shows up at school. The boys are not happy that Dad has been spying on them. Later on, we see that Sarah breaks up with her boyfriend and quits the cheerleading squad. Lois takes on a missing persons case when a mother comes into the newspaper asking for help. Her son, Derek Powell, took an opportunity of a lifetime with Morgan Edge signing a non-disclosure agreements, and his last message to his mother was a voicemail stating that the opportunity wasn't what he thought, or he wasn't sure what was going to happen to him, so he wanted to tell his mother that he loved her. And we see that someone is spying on Lois. Jordan decides he wants to try out for the football team and shows up to practice. We see that he kicks ass on the field, and later on, Jordan goes one-on-one with Sarah's old boyfriend. And Jordan knocks him to the ground, but then apologizes for kissing Sarah. We see that Lois's car blows up, and Clark is not happy that Jordan joined the football team. Lois finds out the three other workers have gone missing as well, and Lois goes to meet up with Sharon at her motel room, and Lois is attacked. She uses her signaler to call Superman, and Superman shows up, and we find out that the bad guy has super strength. He beats down Superman at first until Superman adjusts using his cold breath and beats the guy down until he takes off. Clark lets Jordan play on the football team, but we also see that Clark volunteers as an assistant coach. At the end of the episode, the mysterious man who fought Superman is driving his car. A woman standing in the middle of the road kills him with her heat vision.
This felt like the show, when Jonathan is so strong in football, that felt like the show was being inconsistent with his powers. Didn't that feel that way to you, Drew?
I didn't think so. I don't think the show has shown us exactly what he can do yet. We know he's supposed to be developing his powers, but we don't know what depth his powers are. We don't know on the football field if that was his using his full super strength or if he was holding back. They really haven't done a good job of telling us exactly what he can do yet.
That's fair. Yeah, I guess I should say maybe inconsistent is the right word, but it feels like the show can't totally make up its mind what he can do. Like you said, we just don't really know.
And one of the things I thought I remembered from when they went to the fortress, I thought Jor-El had told him that he wouldn't be able to control his powers or something.
I thought Jor-El said that he was never going to be able to be on Superman's level.
Right.
And I thought the show went... I mean, obviously we knew that it wasn't going to be the case. Like, obviously Jonathan's going to develop powers. But it made it seem like there wasn't really a whole lot there. Like, it was almost like a freak thing that these powers surfaced when they did.
And so I don't know. So when he was able to go out there and consistently have a, you know, well above average strength, especially for his size, it was like, well, that seems like he has control and a certain level of powers that I swear last episode you told us that he didn't have.
So the show just has not done a good job of telling us what his powers are and what level or anything like that. I agree with you. That's a fault of the shows. Me, I really enjoyed this episode a lot. I think it's, honestly, it's been the best one so far yet. And it's really, really starting to get into the life of the Kent family. Superman spying on the boys didn't surprise me, but there again, there's another mistake Clark's made. He's been making a lot of mistakes as a parent. And go ahead.
On that, that's a good note. So I've as I mentioned, I pitched this show to my girlfriend as it's a show about Superman being a bad parent. And again, we see him making poor parenting choices. And then we also see Lana making some really terrific parenting choices, like berating your daughter in front of the whole cheerleading squad. A-plus parenting. She was watching this with me, and I was like, I just don't understand why this show seems to go out of its way to have them be bad parents. And she's like, well, they're trying to appeal to their target audience. And I was like,
I guess that does make sense,
and
doesn't it?
She was exactly right, because that's one of the things that you have to – and I do – she's right. And I do worry about how that's going to work for this show, because I think the show, in theory, wants to be about the parents, Lois and Superman. But it's being written to appeal to its audience, and who CW has gone like triple and quadruple down on, their audience being teenagers. And so I feel like the show is a little bit at odds, where it wants Lois and Clark to be the main characters, and yet it wants to appeal to the teenagers' plights. And, Dad, you're so embarrassing. And I don't know how you can strike that balance with this show without making I feel like you inevitably have to make the kids the main characters. If you're leaning into being a show for teenagers. And then that just got us on a longer conversation with, put my thumb on, I've expressed this to her and I think to you, that I just recently have not enjoyed the CW shows as much as I did. Like when Arrow and Flash first started, I was so in and invested on these shows, Drew. And not that I don't still enjoy them. Like I still enjoy Flash, Black Lightning. This show's pretty good for the most part, but I have struggled sometimes with why I don't enjoy them as much. And I think sometimes it's just because they're not as well made. But I feel like there's just been a big paradigm shift. When Arrow first started, I'm curious what you think. I don't think CW had fully committed to being a teenager network when Arrow first started. And so it wasn't obsessed with appealing to that target audience. But as we know, it has since very much gone 100% all in on being a show for teens, or a TV network for teens. And I do think that that's had an effect on the shows. And I do think that's part of why I haven't enjoyed them as much, because I'm 30. Like I'm too far past the target audience now.
Well, you just answered a question for me. I've been wondering lately. I'm like, I wonder how old Cletus is now. He's hit the big 3-0.
I have, yeah.
And your perspectives are changing.
But I don't think, but see, like I was not in my teens when these shows started. I was, you know what I mean? So like,
yeah.
I was not saying that I was old and mature. That's not what I meant. But like, I was never, the entire Arrowverse timeline, I have never been in the teenage target audience group. And I enjoyed them much more at the beginning of this. And I do feel, and this is just a personal theory of mine, I do feel like the paradigm shift at CW has changed these shows fundamentally in a way that have made them just a little less appealing to me.
Go back and look at season one of Arrow. Go back and look at season one of Flash. You can tell there's a tonal difference from what what they were in later seasons. So I have to agree with it. The network has geared more of its stuff toward teenagers. Just look at the shows they put out now compared to 5 years ago. So you can definitely see the shift in their theme.
But anyway, I wouldn't necessarily say that's a rant, but it was more just like, I've enjoyed this show, but I do feel every episode I've seen, I've always felt like slightly unsatisfied with it. And I think that's, for me, the thing that I'm not 100% enjoying the show. Like I have a good time when I watch it, and I want to keep watching it, but there's always a little bit like, I didn't, there was a little bit I didn't like there. And I feel like it's that the show is sort of wrestling with, it wants to be about the parents, but it wants its audience to be invested in the teenagers. And so it kind of has to be more about how unfair the adults are and how unjust the world is to teenagers. And it can't, and it's kind of stuck there. Like, it doesn't fully work. Like, it can't be about the two adult characters and yet be about the plight of the teenagers. Like, it has to pick one.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. The show's kind of wrestling with itself, and one of them's going to win out over the other. Right now,
and I know, to be fair, I know that the show is trying to be a little bit like an insight into, you know, the struggles of being a parent and trying to reach your children and you know, be a good parent and all of that. But I feel like the show leans more towards the child's perspective, that like, it is, personally, I feel like the show frequently comes from the angle of the kid is ultimately the one in the right, and it's the adult that needs to adjust. And not that that's not the case sometimes, it certainly is, but when you're constantly coming from that angle, that's, I feel like that's being colored by the fact that that's the side that you're trying to appeal to audience-wise.
Well, we definitely see Clark trying to be more in his kid's life in this episode. When he finally relents and lets Jordan play, we see that he volunteers as the assistant coach. And I think it's kind of funny that it kind of felt like a callback to Superman the movie, at least to me, about Clark helping out with being the assistant coach, end up doing the laundry and getting the water cooler and all that stuff. I don't know. I kind of found it kind of funny. All right. Anything else we want to say about this episode?
No. I mean, to be clear, I am enjoying the show. There's that little bit that I feel like there's room for improvement, and I feel like I've kind of narrowed in on the thing that I think that the show could improve on, but I don't think that it will improve on that. I think that's just how it's going to be.
Well, we also have to remember we're only the third episode into the series, so
yeah. But can you really tell me, Drew, that you think that the show isn't ultimately going to veer more towards the kids?
No, I can't tell you that. I can hope it stays focused on Clark and Lois, but we'll see what happens. We'll see if that's what happens. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Flash, Season 7, Episode 2, The Speed of Thought. The episode opens up with a memorial for Wells. Allegra gets a message from Iris telling her to be careful because Eva is watching. Meet at the Speed Lab at 1900 hours, which is 7 p.m. Cisco is using Atlantean tech to open a porthole to the Mirrorverse, but it isn't working. Chester is off visiting his grandmother this weekend, we find out. And we also see that Barry has picked up a new power because of the artificial speed force, speed thinking. Oh, we see Barry being his own man in the chair this week. And the side effect of that is becoming more logical and less emotional. Barry needs some of Eva's dark particles to open up the portal to the Mirrorverse. Killer Frost helps out, and Barry is able to collect those particles. Barry also figures out Eva's secret. Eva is dead, but a mirror copy of her is the one that they are facing. While Eva is on television, Barry releases the real footage of Eva dying. This is to distract Eva so they can open a portal to the Mirrorverse. Sisko realizes what is going on with Barry and has an intervention with Frost and Allegra. Frost injects Velocity X and chases Barry around the city trying to stop him. When the trio think they have the upper hand, Barry takes them out. We see Barry opens a mirror portal and forces Iris through it, and Iris has some sort of seizure and falls unconscious. Barry realizes what he has done and destroys the artificial speed force. This forces his body to lose his lightning. Eva is having some sort of mental breakdown when she realizes she can make this her world, and we see her attack a police officer from an elevator mirror. We get a Once Upon a Time scene from Season 1 where Eobard Thawne becomes Harrison Wells and then buries him in the ground. Somehow, that original Harry Wells resurrects. I gotta tell you, Cletus, this was a great season finale.
You cannot tell me that that was not meant to be a season finale scene. Maybe the episode itself may have changed a little bit. I'm sure it did. There were some adjustments made to it. But that concluding scene was 1,000% a season finale scene. There's no way you can tell me otherwise, especially because it ended with "to be continued." Of course it's going to be continued. It's episode 2.
This definitely felt like a season finale to me. And you called it last episode. It was definitely felt like a season finale. The thing was, the villain felt like Barry. Barry was the villain against himself in this episode.
I'm curious to see the next episode because it seemed like there was going to be a big climactic fight next episode. And so I wonder if we're getting, if this was maybe the penultimate episode potentially, or a loose version of what was supposed to be the penultimate episode. I don't know. Be kind of curious to see what next one looks like. If there's a big climactic fight against Mirror Master, that would make me think that they just mixed a few scenes around, like that the Eobard scene was meant to be a season finale scene, but then the fight would obviously be season finale. I don't know. I would love to get a really nice behind the scenes account of this when this season's all done, and just kind of get what was supposed to have happened last season. How was that supposed to have ended? What were they going to do this season, and how, and then what changed, and what was sort of, you know, I don't know. I would love to get an account of that when this is all wrapped up.
What was weird was we just got the artificial speed force, and Barry has already destroyed it this episode.
For now.
Yeah, for now. Though, I mean, sure, they'll rebuild it. I hope they don't take long to rebuild it, or even waste time, that much time rebuilding it. Yeah. Because I want to move on from Barry not having a speed. That gets old quick. I'm really curious about Harrison Wells. Are we going to get the original Harrison Wells? Or is it going to be an Eobard Thawne version of Harrison Wells again? I'm kind of curious about that.
My interpretation is that's the original Harrison Wells. But we'll certainly see. It was really great seeing the, I don't know his name, but the other actor that plays him, Eobard. That was great to see. I would, if he's not doing anything, I would love to get him back on the show at some point.
Me too. I love him as Reverse Flash. And I'm hoping we get some Reverse Flash this season. We don't have to have him in the season majorly, but episode or two, that would be great.
Yeah, have them just pop in briefly to be antagonistic and go away. One of those things, every time they do something like that, it works more and more towards them being these bitter, hated rivals, right? Because, like, you know, we know it as comic book fans, and we know it from Eobard's perspective in Season 1 that the two hate each other. But Barry obviously doesn't understand that. But as we go more and more into these seasons and you see these moments between the two of them, you can see the rivalry that Season 1 Eobard is talking about.
Definitely. All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
So it has nothing to do with DC or Marvel for that matter, but wanted to give a shout out to, I think I've shout out about this comic series before, but I just read the most recent volume of it, and I wanted to give it another shout out. But there's a graphic novel series that is, I would say the target audience is probably young adult, but it's such a good comic, and the artwork is such a good art style, called Castle in the Stars, and it's by a French artist who writes and draws the thing, and obviously it's translated. The whole thing is basically the space race, but set in the 1800s instead. And so it's set in Bavaria, and King Ludwig, who's famous for Neuschwanstein Castle, the last king of Bavaria, is sort of behind the idea for the space race. And so instead of him in history, he either commits suicide or is killed under mysterious circumstances, whatever. He dies. Bavaria becomes part of the newly formed Germany. In this, instead, he goes off to space with the main characters in an 1800s version of a spaceship. And the fourth book that I just read is called A Frenchman on Mars. And it's pretty good. So if you like kind of like a alternate history, it very much like an adventure book, check it out. It's a really good comic.
That sounds interesting. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about the Flopcast episode 462, because I was on there this past week, and Kevin and I did our top 4.5 list of goofy DC characters. Check it out and see which goofy DC characters made our list. Also, for National Whatever Day, Cornflake talks about a certain DC celebrity's 50th birthday, and here's a hint. It could be a Doom Patrol villain Cletus and I have discussed before. So check that out. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line at 317-564-9133. Leave us a message. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus. Coming up next week, we've got Sensational Wonder Woman, Superman Red and Blue, Catwoman, Nightwing, Justice League, and of course our CW shows. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go.
You sure this is necessary?
The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone? But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.